This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
$250 million ago, massive volcanic eruptions caused warming, low oxygen, and acidification in the sea. That wiped out around 90% of ocean life, scientists think. It's been called the Great Dying. But what killed the land animals? Widespread extinctions are happening now, so we better know how this can work. A new answer comes with the paper Dying in the Sun: Direct Evidence for Elevated UVB Radiation at the End Permian Mass Extinction. Dr. Barry Lomax is one of the authors. He is professor and chair of plant paleobiology at the University of Nottingham, UK. Lomax has been investigating ancient plants and climate for a very long time. From Nottingham, Barry Lomax, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to talk to your listeners about the work that we've been doing.
Yes, indeed. Could you introduce us to the extreme events your team studied so long ago? What happened?
Yes, so essentially the whole mass extinction event appears to be a biosphere response to an ancient paleo climate emergency. So around about 250 million years ago, the Siberian Traps, which is a large igneous province, erupted. And as part of that eruption cycle, it produced vast amounts of CO2, which drove global warming. And then linked to that, the volcanic eruptions and the volcanic gases were thought to have generated ozone-depleting chemicals, which got up into the atmosphere, destroyed the ozone layer, and then subjected the terrestrial biosphere to an increase in UVB radiation.
Do we know how hot it was back then, say, compared to today?
It's difficult to say with certainty, but there's been evidence that certainly sea surface temperatures in the tropics would have been up to around 40 degrees Celsius.
What is UVB radiation? How does it damage living things?
Yes, so UVB radiation is part of light, and most UVB radiation is filtered out by a stratospheric ozone layer, which is located about 12 kilometres up from the Earth's surface. Previously, human activity was implicated in catalytic destruction of the ozone layer. So back in the 1980s, scientists noticed that the ozone layer over Antarctica was thinning, and that was a result of the injection of CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, into the stratosphere, causing ozone damage.
Well, you mentioned volcanic activity, and I noticed a 2019 study led by Hans Brenna looking at volcanic activity during the last 200,000 years, pretty recent, and they found, quote, global long-lasting impact on the ozone layer affecting atmospheric composition and circulation for a decade. Barry, what made your team investigate UVB impact so long ago, 250 million years ago?
It's a story that's a long time in coming to fruition. So back in around about 2004, I was working at the University of Sheffield as part of a team looking to develop a way of determining past levels of UVB based on pollen and spore wall chemistry. And in 2005, Henk Fisher and colleagues published a paper where they found an increase in the abundance of malformed pollen and spores at the Permo-Triassic boundary, so 250 million years ago. And they suggested in their paper that this was driven by stratospheric ozone depletion driven by the Siberian Trap. So we've been trying to find chemical evidence for that event ever since that paper was published.
And your work includes several studies using fossil leaves to determine climate. And I first learned about that in a 2008 interview with Dr. Bob Spicer. Can you talk about how this deep time method science tool developed?
Yes, intrinsically with plants, they sense CO2 and adapt to the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere by moderating their number of stomata on their leaf surface. So when you have periods of high CO2, plants adapt to have fewer stomata on their leaf surface. And when you have periods of low CO2, plants have more stomata on their leaf surface. And they do this as a way to kind of balance water use efficiency so they can become particularly efficient. So with high atmospheric CO2, they can have fewer stomata and lose less water but still be able to undergo photosynthesis and grow, whereas if you have a lower CO2 atmosphere, obviously the plant needs to have more stomata to capture the carbon, which becomes less available. And as a consequence of that, they need more stomata. So what we've done previously, again, back when I was doing my PhD in the University of Sheffield, we used this method to determine how atmospheric CO2 may have changed as a function of the bolide impact that killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Well, I'm a little confused. You led a paper in 2019 finding a carbon isotope in plant tissue is not a reliable measure of ancient atmospheres. Does that relate to what we're just talking about?
So that's a separate method. So the 2019 study was purely looking at a method that other people had proposed, where it was just purely the isotopic composition of the carbon in the plant tissue that could be used as a proxy for CO2. And that doesn't work because there are more things governing the isotopic composition of a leaf than just the CO2. And in the models that had suggested that the carbon isotope composition of the leaf tissue was the driver of CO2, that's the only thing that they took into account. But it doesn't work because there are more things that control the carbon isotope composition of leaf tissue than just CO2, and when you include those in, they become a much bigger driver of the change than just the CO2. But from a stomatal point of view, that relationship works well. And if you combine stomatal data with isotopic data, you get a very reliable signal. It's just if you use the isotope data on its own, it becomes less useful.
So if there was a giant lack of ozone in the atmosphere 250 million years ago, what would have happened to plants and animals?
So the main thing that would have responded from a kind of working up through the ecosystem, the paper that we've just published in Science Advances has recorded that plants responded to this ozone depletion event by upregulating their UVB-absorbing compounds to provide them with a degree of protection. So that's one of the mechanisms where plants may seek to survive or be less vulnerable. But the other thing that happens when plants are exposed to elevated UVB is that these same compounds which they use as their sunscreen-like protection also makes their leaf tissue, which becomes increasing those compounds, less palatable to herbivores. So you end up in a situation where you have plants that are surviving, which are drastically fewer in number. Their leaf tissue becomes less palatable to herbivores and probably less nutritious. So it can then have the capacity to cascade up through the kind of trophic layers where plant-herbivore interactions become limited. The plant tissue becomes less nutritious, less easy to digest. And that can be a double-edged sword. Because plants growing today, we know when we've done experiments, when you grow plants at elevated atmospheric CO2, one of the responses that occurs is that you have a dilution in nitrogen. So if your animals need nitrogen from the leaf tissue, that becomes diluted down. So not only is there a likelihood that the leaf tissue in itself become less palatable, harder to digest, it's also likely to be of a lower nutritional quality.
Before the world woke up and took action, scientists and environmentalists warned about the damage from the sun if the protective ozone layer was cut. And we heard about rabbits going blind in Peru and a lot of impacts. In your new science, were you more concerned about this direct damage or relationships between the UVB radiation and other volcanic effects?
The primary aim of the project and the study was to determine whether this had happened. So it had been theorized before based on the evidence of malformed spores, and then some chemical modeling of the atmosphere suggested that the Siberian traps could have been a source of ozone depletion. But until we found the chemical signal, that was all kind of first order theory. What we were interested in trying to determine is whether it could have happened, because the UVB absorbing compounds that found in the plants and in their pollen and in their spores is a very specific signal telling us about ozone depletion.
The Montreal Protocol banned CFCs, the prime chemical damaging the ozone inner atmosphere, but the ozone hole is still there. The latest scientific reports are more optimistic that it may heal. Are we able to compare the state of ozone during the Great Dying to conditions now?
So we can indirectly. So the paper I just mentioned that I was involved in around about 2008, 2007, looked at how the Siberian Traps eruptions would have impacted upon ozone depletion. And what that showed is that we could have evidence, depending on the duration of the eruption, that the world would have had a very thin, almost global ozone hole. And then more recently, last year, a group of workers out of the UK published a paper in Nature, which did a really elegant modelling study to see what would have happened to the Earth system if the Montreal Protocol hadn't have been enacted. And in that paper, they had this kind of world-avoided scenario where humanity failed to intercede and stop the production of CFCs. And then they ran that through, and what happened, the end result was almost a global ozone hole over the entire world. And their ozone column depth was pretty similar. Well, the ozone column thickness was pretty similar to our modelling results of the end Permian. And then what they did is they investigated what would have happened to terrestrial vegetation and terrestrial carbon cycling if the global ozone hole had been allowed to develop. And what they showed there was a huge reduction in the efficiency of the terrestrial carbon cycle and an increase in atmospheric CO2 as a result of this global kind of switch off of vegetation through high UVB.
So we may have just dodged a big bullet leading towards extinction as recently as 1988.
Yes, certainly. I mean, it's one of these things which was, when I read the paper through, it was a sobering kind of connection of joining the dots together, thinking about just how kind of lucky we've got, or more importantly, just how important environmental legislation is, because this is this, at the time when the Montreal Protocol was put in place, the linkage between UVB and terrestrial carbon cycling was unknown, and it was primarily a human health thing and rather than a kind of thinking about climate change. But yes, it certainly was a sobering reflection.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the UK. Our guest is paleobiologist Dr. Barry Lomax. We are tracking what almost killed life on Earth around 250 million years ago. We don't really know a lot about volcanoes even now, but so far, experts are not predicting thousands of years of massive eruptions like the end Permian. Do we know how many large eruptions it would take to damage our ozone layer? Could it happen again?
I mean, certainly from the perspective of kind of Earth history, if something's happened, it's likely to happen again. But the time periods of those repeats, I simply don't know.
And there's another aspect to play here. We only learned in the last century how absolutely toxic mercury is for most plants and animals. How does mercury figure in the process of that ancient mass extinction event?
Yes, yeah, so obviously mercury is a horrible kind of cytotoxic element which is fatal to a lot of organisms. In the mass extinction world, it's been used as a really good tool to provide us evidence of volcanic activity. So in the paper that we've just published, we see that our sunscreen compounds are upregulated in the pollen wall coincident with a spike in mercury, and it's that spike in mercury that can tell us about the eruptions. And then we've had colleagues who previously worked on a later mass extinction event, the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, which is 200 million years ago, and there they've shown quite nicely that when they have a increase in mercury, they see an increase in abundance of malformed fern spores. So it's definitely something that's ongoing under research, and it's something that's coming to light. In the lab at the moment, we're running a whole load of mercury experiments to see what happens to plants when they're grown in mercury-contaminated soils, see how they function and whether they produce these malformed pollen and or spores.
It sounds like this mass extinction event may not have been just one thing, but an unfortunate concatenation of environmental deterioration. Can we pin UVB as the driver of that mass extinction on land, or is it one deadly player among others?
I think it's probably part of the problem or part of the driving mechanisms towards extinction. I think it's really difficult to unpick actual drivers, and because it's a kind of causal relational soup, and it's undoubtedly things are happening, and being able to pick out a single driver is very challenging. A couple of years ago, Jeff Benker and colleagues in Berkeley published a really nice paper on pollen from pollen malformations from their elevated UVB experiments, and what they showed is that plants seem to survive the incredibly high levels of UVB that they simulated in their experiments, but they induced kind of sterility, so there was a lack of female comb setting, the male pollen was infertile. So although the UVB didn't kill these plants, it certainly made them less fit and kind of would have had severe impacts on kind of generational timing and replacement. If you'd had volcanic eruptions to the end Permian going on, I think the best guess is something like 60,000 years of volcanic eruptions. That's a really neat way of kind of taking out juveniles and kind of stopping forest replacement rather than it being a instantaneous kill mechanism, if that makes sense.
It does. And as I understand it, the new study depends on an analysis of pollen grains taken in Tibet. How can you know that the radiation event was global rather than a local reading?
Yes, so we've been, this is the next stage of the research, is to think about finding the signal in other locations. We currently have money from the Human Frontiers Science Program where we're starting to look for the signal in different places at different latitudes. So that's the next big thing, really, is to see whether we can see these signals at other locations to give us an idea of how likely the ozone hole is to have developed over kind of a broader geographic time period, or spatially, rather.
There have been other theories on the cause of the great dying. For example, Dr. Peter Ward suggested a dying ocean switched to sulfur-based bacteria that emitted clouds of toxic hydrogen sulfide gas. Is there still room for debate on what caused the greatest challenge to life on this planet?
The challenge is definitely the event occurred 250 million years ago, even for someone who studies geological time, is a long time ago. And being able to directly unpack these events is difficult. I know Peter's study suggested a kind of ocean overturning and degassing of hydrogen sulfide into the atmosphere. I think that was done using a very simple 1D chemistry model. And when people used a slightly more advanced model, that overturn didn't occur and we didn't get hydrogen sulfide degassing into the atmosphere. So it's one of these things where it's that kind of advancement and kind of both technologies that enable more sophisticated modeling. And then with the instrumentation, the work that we've been doing that enable smaller sample sizes to be analyzed, more specific kind of targeted analysis based on our understanding of plant physiology and plant biochemistry and linking those things together, it could be possible. Again, one of the challenges, though, is just the order of magnitude of the event and just how long the ecosystem or the terrestrial biosphere takes to recover. So following the extinction event on land, there's something like a 10 million year coal gap where there's just no forest. If there is forest establishment, those plants aren't being preserved in great detail in the geological record. So it makes the early Triassic a really interesting but incredibly frustrating time to study, because undoubtedly things are going on that we kind of, they're of such an order of magnitude that they're affecting how plants particularly are preserved. So we're missing that kind of information.
One test of climate models is to run them backward in time to see if they can produce results matching what we know from other sources. And we need these models to plan our future, if we can plan it. Do climate models show pulses of mass extinction? And can your new science help make the models more accurate?
So one of the things that we're working on at the moment is, and this is stuff that is being very much led by Paul Valdez in Bristol, is kind of the next generation of climate models, linking them together, being more, I mean, as computational time has got cheaper, it enables more elaborate models to be run. And then what you can do is ground truth the models against the paleo record, so we can compare the proxy data to the model outputs and then kind of iteratively solve between the two to make the models better at reproducing the system.
How do you feel that this really applies to us now? What are we getting from this new knowledge?
So it's difficult to place it directly within a framework of kind of current-day climate change, because the Earth system 250 million years ago was very different to what we find today. I mean, the continents were completely differently configured. That impacts hugely upon heat flow. There was only one large ocean body, one continent, and those types of things. And how these things fit together impacts on climate. So, but what the work does tell us, it tells us about how the Earth system responds to shocks, tells us about what's resilient, what isn't resilient, and how the system works when we transition from one stable state to another stable state, or indeed to an unstable state. So it gives us information on how the Earth system works, which enables us to predict what might happen, but it doesn't give us a clear analog for the future.
From the University of Nottingham, we have been speaking with the chair of plant paleobiology, Dr. Barry Lomax. He is co-author of the paper Dying in the Sun, Direct Evidence for Elevated UVB Radiation at the End Permian Mass Extinction. Find links to follow up in my show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Barry Lomax, thank you so much for sharing your time with our listeners.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me on your show. Cheers.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This interview with Barry Lomax is a parable about the critical, absolutely essential need for real emergency action to save this planet from rapid climate change. Did you know plants could make their own sunscreen, but animals find that hard to digest? Did you know rising UVB radiation eventually leaves much more carbon in the atmosphere? Plants are miracle chemical factories, aren't they? Some plants manage to create their own sunscreen just to protect their leaves from radiation. Perhaps they evolved that capability many million years before. But most plants died off due to radiation change. That changed the carbon cycle. Remember, the bit of carbon you and I add to the atmosphere daily does not just sit there for 100,000 years. Our carbon is dragged out of long-term storage deep in the earth. It re-enters the carbon cycle. It may be captured by land plants or sea plants or soil organisms or be tossed into the sea. But eventually, that same bit of carbon comes back into the atmosphere. Our additional carbon just adds to the amount of stuff cycling around. More carbon dioxide is found in the atmospheric stage, which is what matters directly for warming. But if a significant number of those carbon-grabbing plants die, the carbon pump weakens and more CO2 stays in the atmosphere. In that way, when the protective ozone layer weakens, global warming is an eventual end result. I always wondered at the connection between the ozone layer and climate change, and now we know. Plants are the intermediate mechanism. When the Montreal Protocol was signed in 1987 and enacted in 1990, the whole reason was to protect human health. Scientists and doctors knew more about radiation, and that would lead to excess cancer, especially deadly skin cancer. They did not know, and nobody knew, that a weaker ozone layer would boost global warming. Action to save the ozone layer was taken, just in time, without knowing the most powerful threat. That is where we are now with climate change. We know too many reasons why global warming could wreck our lives and our civilization, but probably we only know the half of it. The story of UVB explains we must act on imperfect knowledge. Once 30 years ago, humans managed to act as one species to save ourselves. We banned ozone-depleting chemicals. But now, again facing a threat as great as our own extinction, we have so far failed to act. We could still save ourselves from outright catastrophe. We still have an atmosphere friendly to humans and all our kindred animals and plants. That nurturing atmosphere is being destroyed in front of our very eyes. We must change fundamentally our way of life, our beliefs and assumptions. Humanity has no golden ticket out of this, out of the long Earth history of creation and destruction of species. In fact, we are among the most fragile animals, with strict and limited environmental needs. There are no guarantees, no guardian angels to swoop in, and no easy way out. There is a difficult way out, which is partly the way back to where we were when we were a sustainable species. But there is still a way out, and that is a limited time offer. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock this week and caring about our world.